Okay, so this is week 9. We're heading rapidly towards week 12, but we've got a big job to do between now and week 12, and that is we've got to create a play. But before we create a play, we've got a few bits of tidying up to do, bits of preparation for your next written assignment. And so let's begin. Now, first of all, your next written assignment, which you have on this sheet here, and which is also in Leo. Let's go there just to show you where it is if you lose the sheet or whatever. So when you go into it, you will now see, on the bottom of written assignments, you'll see writing task drama, and you'll see the box to put the drama task in there. So if you click on writing task drama, that's what you'll find. The due date for the draft to be worked on with the learning partner is next week, May the 13th. That's the draft. And then you've got 2 weeks produce the final copy, May the 27th. So, what do you have to do? You've got to, in no more than 600 words, respond to the following statement. The language of drama is much more than just words on a page. The genre of drama forces language to get up, walk, talk, sing, and do all kinds of body movements in order to bring the written text to life. Discuss this statement, making reference where possible to your own participation in the production of As You Like It. You may, if you wish, also make reference to your attendance at the Bell Shakespeare production of this play and to the discussion with John Bell after the show. The recording of this discussion is in Leo. Suggestion: to support part of your discussion, take one small section of the play As You Like It, maybe 5 or 10 lines, and explore how a director's instruction to the actor, the stage manager, the costume designer, the lighting and sound technician will help to add life to the text on the page. Important note, please review the rubric at the end of the unit outline on how this assignment is going to be marked. Please ensure that your essay is carefully checked for grammatical errors and spelling mistakes. We're going to be working on that in about 15 minutes. All references to both primary and secondary texts must be made using MLA, but I will say here that I'm not expecting you to make many references to secondary texts. This is an essay that's based on your own experience and understanding. Yes, you can reference the primary text if you quote from As You Like It, and the primary text is the one that I've handed out to you already, and I've got more copies here if you need it. And then there are two links. If you're on Leo, you can actually, if you want to know more about MLA, you can actually click on the link there and it will take you there. MLA is something that's worth at least having a rudimentary understanding of, because when you come to ACU and study literature, you have to use MLA. So that's that. Well, let me just hop straight into part of the content for this essay. Quick question, sure.
What's the distinction between a primary reference and a secondary?
Okay, primary reference is the basic text that you're talking about, As You Like It, right, or the poem or the novel, the primary text. And a secondary text is a criticism about that. Or it could be a web commentary about it, a web link. So that's the difference. So I've got a few slides here that kind of just open up and illustrate the whole question of the language of drama, which is really what your essay is about. Your essay is about trying to think about how words, when they're performed, are different to words when they're written as a story or words when they're written as a poem. What are the extra ingredients? Well, one of the first extra ingredients is the stage. There have been different kinds of theatres since the beginning of time. You've got the ancient Greek theatre here, which was actually kind of like a religious ceremony. And you've got Shakespeare's The Globe Theatre here, which was built with a huge open hole in the middle at the top, like the globe. And I think Shakespeare saw his theatre as a kind of a mirror of the world. You know, he says all the world's a stage and we are merely players. And he kind of meant it, really, that this stage was like a mirror of life in the world at large. And all these other stages coming through to modern stages, like this modern stage here in the Sydney Opera House, constructed for a play. So the theatre itself makes a certain statement. It kind of contributes to how the play presents itself. When we saw As You Like It at the Opera House, it was a very modern setting, really. It wasn't very Shakespearean. They had all these kind of fancy things coming out of the ceiling with flowers hanging down, and this gave quite a modern flavour to that play. And when we do our version of As You Like It out there in that room over there, we have a stage. We have to create a stage. We have to create a stage. We have to create the action. So how is that going to sort of help, enhance, add something to what the play means? So here's All the World's a Stage and We Are Merely Players. And you know that the word theatre comes from the word theatron, the Greek word theatron, and it means a seeing place, a place where you can see something. And actually, for the great Greek literary theorist Aristotle, I'm sure some of you have heard of Aristotle, who is famous for his book Poetics. And Poetics was his study of literature, poetry, drama, fiction. You can find Poetics on the web. You can read it if you want. But for Aristotle, the theatre was a seeing place in the sense that it produced this. That's a word that he invented, and it means that somehow what you see changes your life. Catharsis means that what you see on stage, the terrible things that you see on stage, or the happy things that you see on stage, has some impact on your experience. So theatre was a place where human beings could see themselves mirrored. They could see their own lives mirrored. And you know, the great tragedies of Shakespeare or Sophocles, the great tragedies mirrored just how desperate human beings could become. There's that terrible story about Oedipus Rex, who discovers that he's been sleeping with his mother and he's killed his father, and in desperation he tears his own eyes out, and you've got this picture of a man on stage, blood pouring out of his face after he's been blinded. So that's, you know, a horrific outcome, and many of the Greek plays were like that. Shakespeare's tragedies, like King Lear, like Othello, where this beautiful couple, Amour and his wife Desdemona, happily married, but the pressures of society get to them so much, and he becomes infuriatingly jealous about some man who he thinks is having an affair with his wife, and he goes one night and he stabs his wife. And, you know, it's a desperate tragedy, because he's a good man, she's a good woman, and yet circumstances have conspired to produce this tragedy. And a lot of Shakespeare's tragedies are like that. So what did these tragedies aim to do? They aim to somehow impact on the audience. So the audience would go out and say, I'm never going to do that. I'm never going to be like that. Catharsis. That's what catharsis was. And Aristotle really, he invented the kind of structure of a play with five acts and characters, which Shakespeare inherited and kind of developed in the 16th and 17th century. So there's a picture of the Greek drama, the Greek space, which, you know, the Greek plays used to be like religious services. Characters used to come on and, you know, it was almost like a religious mass being said there. And there were, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 people would attend these amazing presentations. And this is, you know, a photograph of the ruin as it still stands today. And there's a recreation of what it would have been like back in the olden days. And here are some of the the terms that are used in drama that's still current nowadays. So there's catharsis, which I've just talked about. In a play, you have a protagonist. A protagonist is the main actor, the one who's got the desire to do something, to be something, to become something, and then the antagonist is that which the person that opposes him. So all drama is made up out of conflict. All drama really works because there's conflict happening on stage. And at the end of conflict, there's either tragic outcome or there's resolution. In the play that we saw, Shakespeare's As You Like It, it's called a comedy, not because it's funny, although there are parts of it that are funny, but it's called a comedy because it has a positive outcome and a tragedy has a negative outcome. So at the end of As You Like It, what we're going to be working on is a part of the play where everybody gets married and lives happily ever after. And that's a lot of Shakespeare's comedies have that kind of ending. Flowers in the air and everybody happy, and some people not quite so happy, but they're all getting married and they're all going to go off to bed together. That's what Shakespeare felt was a beautiful outcome for his plays. It's interesting that Shakespeare, actually in the middle of his career, he wrote a whole bunch of tragedies, King Lear, Othello, Hamlet, Macbeth, and then at the end of his career he wrote all these comedies, The Tempest, As You Like It, Winter's Tale, and so it was as if at the end of his life he needed to kind of bring some lightness into his dramatic productions. The word mimesis here, mimesis is mirroring. If something is mimetic, it imitates or copies or mirrors life. So drama was often mimetic. And then you had the tragic hero, that's the person who is the centre of a tragedy. A tragicomedy, you get some plays that are both tragic and comic, you get a mixture of genres. So even within the... we're talking about drama here. Drama is like a third genre we've been looking at. We've been looking at poetry, prose, and drama. But within drama, there are subgenres. There's tragicomedy, there's comedy, there's tragedy, there's history. Shakespeare liked to write histories. Henry IV Part 1, Henry IV Part 2, Henry VIII, Richard III. So there are different genres within drama. So, the language of theatre, okay? First thing is that you can say that drama has physical components that are used on stage. And some of the most obvious physical components is actual people standing there in costumes with makeup, and then there are props and there's lighting and there's sound, so all those sorts of things are part of the language. Drama is a literary form whose medium is more than just written language. It is a composite art form utilizing elements of the expressive arts. Expressive arts, not the literary arts. Expressive arts is dance, music, everything. Movement, position, gesture, mime. Expressive arts and the plastic arts. Plastic arts are painting, sculpture, lighting. All these things to communicate its message. Now I'm going to be putting this whole set of slides up onto Leo. So if you don't get it all down now, it doesn't matter, you can look at it later. So you can see here this horrific image of Medea, at the end of a terrible murder scene here, holding, you know, a bloodied head in her hand. So any playwright, before he or she puts pen to paper, must realize that his text is just the first stage in an elaborate exchange of talents that will bring director, producer, actors, stage and costume designers and sound technicians and musicians together. And, you know, there have been some really interesting debates, public debates, here in Australia about 5 years ago. David Williamson wrote a new play and he disagreed with the director's interpretation of it. And David Williamson said the play should represent it this way. And the director said, well, hang on a second, you've written the play, but you don't have rights over how the play is going to be directed. And it's interesting, this whole question, is a play owned by the playwright? And, you know, Shakespeare very rarely wrote any directions. I mean, he'd say, character walk off stage, exeunt, or, you know, all the other characters leaving. But he never wrote in detailed descriptions of how the character should look or how they should stand or what their facial position should be, etc. But some dramatists do, especially some modern dramatists, like Bernard Shaw, for example. They write lots of things into their play. You almost get the sense that they would prefer to be writing a novel rather than a play. They want the actor to do exactly what they want, what they want the outcome to be. So there's different traditions there. So a play is like a piece of music. It will be played differently by each new director and his cast. Any piece of music, there's the score. This group of musicians will do this, and this group of musicians will do this. So physical qualities are then added to every word. A word on a page is one thing, but a word expressed in the theatre is something completely different. And, you know, what shapes that word, the whole physical context, the choice of the actor or actress to begin with, you know, if you choose an actor who's very strong and powerful in the physical presence, then you can be guaranteed that the actor's going to have some of those qualities on stage. But there are other things. There are more subtle things also, and that's these ones here, additional extra-linguistic features. You liked that term, Mike, last week. The extra-linguistic features. Added to linguistic. You know, words have got linguistic features, their meaning, their sound, their denotation, their connotation. But when those words are put on stage, the director can insist on the tempo of delivery, on pauses, on emphasis, on inflection. Am I going to say my word like this or like this? Intonation, which part is going to be emphasized? These are very subtle things. And you know, a director who works on a play can work for weeks to just get it exactly right to express what he or she thinks the play ought to be doing. Just like a conductor has to tune the orchestra so that, you know, the double bass doesn't play too loud here and the cymbals don't crash too loud here. You've got a certain vision of how the whole piece of music goes together. Sorry? I am. Self-styled director. I'll take all the blame. Okay. So, theatron is a seeing place. And then there are a few other technical words here. This is a French word that is used in the theatre. Mise en scène means all the design aspects of a theatre or film production. Jean, can you translate mise en scène for us into English? Put into scene, yeah. What happens when you put this into a scene?
Well, you have to think of everything. You have to think of the decor.
That's right.
Of the decor, of the timing.
Yep, the decor, all those. So what have I got here? Setting, physical properties, arrangement of the performers on the stage, positioning of props, instructions given on actors how to present their bodies and their lines. So all that is called sometimes the mise-en-scène. So in drama, words are just one ingredient in a texture of expressive elements. Without movement, gesture, sound projection, and other language effects, the play remains like a silent score of printed music. It's not quite true. It's not quite true, because when you read Shakespeare in the book, you as an individual, you're turning that into, in your imagination, you're turning it into a play. So, you know, reading a play, you can... You're almost the director when you're reading it, and you interpret it as you're reading it, and you put these characters imaginary on a stage in your own head. And if you're a good musician, and most people when they pick up a musical score, it doesn't mean anything to them until they hear the musicians play it. But if you've studied music, then you can read a score. You can do that. So it's not 100% true. So mise-en-scène is an expression used to describe the design aspects of a theatre or film production, which essentially means visual theme or telling a story, both in visually artful ways and stage design and in poetically artful ways through direction. So, okay. There is a lot of overlap between drama and poetry. a lot of overlap between drama and prose as well. You know, a lot of, especially Shakespeare's plays have got a lot of poetry in them. They're actually written in poetic form. A lot of his characters speak in iambic pentameter, which is something we haven't discussed yet, or have we?
Yeah.
We have. So iambic pentameter is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And usually in Shakespeare, it's unrhymed, except at the end, at end of speeches. So Shakespeare, you know, he uses prose and he uses poetry in his dramas for different sorts of effects.
Why is that called prose rather than poetry?
Well, because the big reason why iambic pentameter, unrhymed pentameter, is called poetry and not prose, good question. The main reason is that the big difference between poetry and prose is that poetry always has a regular rhythm and prose does not have a regular rhythm. Like when I'm speaking now, there is a rhythm to my speech, but it's not regular. It's you know, it's often the beats are related to the content words and also to what I feel is necessary at the moment. There's no regularity, but pentameter is very regular. So that gives, for example, the kings in his plays a very stately kind of regular speech, even though it's not rhymed. Good question. So if we had a lot of time, if we were doing a full drama course, we'd compare the way that Beckett and Edward Albee use very minimalist kind of words on the stage, almost like Hemingway in the stories. How in the 19th century, with Chekhov and Strindberg, there was a lot of talk, a lot of explanations. How in the Renaissance with Shakespeare, there were very few stage props. You know, the Globe Theatre in England was a small stage with very little physical props. So a lot of the emphasis in Shakespeare went into the words and in the language. And the Shakespearean audience then had to listen very carefully because Shakespeare often created the scenes in the words themselves. So many different kinds of dramatists and traditions of drama. And there were, along with that, different styles of dramatic instructions for the performers. And I've already covered some of this. So Bernard Shaw, for example, gives enormous instructions. Often he writes a huge preface to the play, outlining what the play means and how the characters should perform. Chekhov does almost nothing. He allows the characters to stand on the stage and allows the director to take over. So does Shakespeare. Eugene O'Neill gives lots of directions. So if we were doing a lot of different drama over the centuries, you'd see that the whole style of the way that a playwright allows a director to work with the play is very different. David Williamson, lots of directions. He wants the director to follow his line, but directors disagree with him and they want to put it on their own way. So this is getting a bit too technical. I don't want to spend much time on this, but sometimes when you're looking at a piece of drama, you sometimes discuss what is called the BPE, the basic pattern of events. You ask, what happens? Why does it happen? When and where does it happen? Who's involved? What do the characters on stage want? What prevents them from getting what they want? Because usually in drama, one character wants something and another character's not going to give it. So there's this tension, and that's what keeps the audience interested. So good drama is always full of conflict right from the start. Like in the beginning of As You Like It, you remember that there's Duke Frederick. He wants to take over the country, and the other duke is forced to go out into the forest. And then there are these two women who fall in love with this man who's about to be wrestled by a wrestler, Charles, and they fall in love with him and they're terrified that he's going to get killed in this wrestling match. So in the beginning, there's all this conflict all the way through. And in the end, there's resolution. Whose phone is this? Nobody here? Sounds very close. Okay. Let's move on. So we've covered that there. That's just a superimposition of the vast Greek stage, which was like a church with thousands of people participating, and here the modern stage, which is often a kind of a blank space with just two actors standing in the middle of it. So this is something that we'll be working on when we actually get to the play. What do you notice about additional extra-linguistic features? How does the selection of actors and their verbal and physical mannerisms change our response to the events? What verbal elements did you notice? Tempo of delivery, pauses, emphasis, inflection. So, you know, when we're going to be rehearsing this play, I've already got a provisional idea of who's going to be what. But that might change as we go, because when I see, you know, that Jean makes a really good Rosalind, I might discover that Greg is an even better Rosalind. So we might do a swap at some point. I've got to kind of work out who's going to work best. And, you know, we're also playing for an audience here, so, you know, it might be really good to have a man play a woman and you know, varieties there. It depends how people speak the lines, whether they speak them forcefully or quietly. One role might need quite a quiet voice. So, and then I'll probably try and tell you to speak this louder or faster or stand this way or stand that way. And, you know, it's just like the beginning. If we had 6 months, we could work towards a fantastic production and all become professional actors. But it's just to get a taste of what the language of drama is all about. And there were some of the people that we saw a few weeks back on the stage, and there are a few people we saw a week back off the stage, and you can see who's pushing forward. This little gentleman here, I won't name him, but he engineered most of this.
Yeah.
Very forthright, very, very, yeah. Okay, so let's go to now you can follow this along on your sheet if you wish, which you've got in front of you. And I think everybody's got this sheet. It might be a bit easier for you to read it on the sheet. In any case, all the comments don't come out quite here, so I'm glad we've got it on the sheet as well. So this is now just to walk through with you. Everybody's essay is included here, by the way. Everybody's essay has some comment. I want to say in general that the essays were really good. I was very pleased with the essays. Most of you really felt that you'd chosen a story that you could say something about, and you really got inside the characters and the situation and were able to find some sense of why the author had bothered writing this story. What I've got on here are some basic issues with your expression, and let me tell you that these issues happen with students on campus as well as off campus. In fact, I spend most of my time with students in first, second, and third year correcting their sentences. And it's my responsibility that at the end of the 3 years they can go out and be English teachers, so it's a big responsibility. They have to know what a sentence is and how it works. Let's just walk through these things, and if you've got any questions at all, we can deal with them. So the first one, the narrative around Mrs. Mallard's... Have you got this mic in front of you? Is it, got it, yep. The narrative around Mrs. Mallard's unhappiness and discontent with her married life, which drives the narrative around her desire to change, full stop. Now, what I've said in the comment, there's something wrong with this sentence. Read it aloud and see if you can spot what's missing. Can anybody spot what's missing? The narrative...
The second half is one sentence, but the first half is half a sentence not properly joined in the first. Going, if you just strike the narrative around and just go, Mrs. Mallard suffers and this point, then strike which, it's a perfect sentence.
So, if you write the narrative around...
Strike the narrative
which.
Around.
Yeah.
Strike the word which.
Yeah. See, that's good. The problem is that which drives the narrative around her desire to change qualifies her unhappiness and discontent. So it becomes a qualifying clause, and so it's not a complete sentence. If you say, I've got the example in the comment over there, but a basic sentence, for example, is the boy eats the apple. Now, let me try and make this example a little closer to the sentence that's an error. The boy eats the apple. So that's a basic sentence, and it's got a subject, and it's got a verb, and it's got the object. If you ask the question, who eats the apple? Who eats? The answer is the subject. In this case, it's the boy. If you ask, the boy eats what? The answer is the object. In this case, the apple. So, who in front of the verb, who eats, the answer is the subject. What after the verb is the object. Now, in our case here, if I write, if I write the boy who is 10, full stop, then that's a subject qualified by this here, the boy who is 10. But then what? What? Where is the verb and where is the object? So to say the narrative around Mrs. Mallard's unhappiness and discontent with her married life, which drives the narrative around a desire to change, is what? So the sentence is not a complete idea, but it could be changed. As Derek said, if you took the word which out, the narrative around Mrs. Mallard's unhappiness and discontent with her married life drives a narrative around her desire to change, that would change the whole nature of that sentence. Then which drives the narrative around her desire to change would be not qualifying part of the subject, but would become an object. So it's interesting, and it's very difficult, actually, to know all the time, is what I've written a complete sentence or not. So if you've got any corrections like this in your essay, then please try and understand it, take it up with your learning partner, come and ask me. It's important to know what makes a complete sentence. Number two, even though we know the story and the people are in fact fictional, the character should manifest human traits which overall contributes to elevating the story to become very close to reality. So quite a few basic problems here. The main problem is the agreement between the subject and the verb. Comment three there on the right-hand side. We know, well, most of us do know that, but, you know, we make mistakes. We know. And then should manifest human traits which overall contributes. Well, what is it that's contributing? It's the human traits that contribute. Traits is plural. So contribute has to be plural. He contributes, but we contribute. They contribute to elevating the story to becoming very close to reality. The verb form there is wrong. Third one. Furthermore, the tone of the prose is one of melancholy, which enhances the theme of loneliness. Now, this is not a grammatical problem. This is a problem of not explaining enough what you meant by the tone of the prose. You know, if you say the tone of the prose is something like melancholy, you need to give some examples from the text. What makes it melancholy? What particular words make it melancholic? Is it the sound of the words? Is it this group of words? So it's a little bit like, as I said at the start of this course, when you're writing a literary essay, you can identify certain things, but you must say how they're connected to the meaning. Or if you find a certain meaning or mood, then show how they're created by the words. You've got to make that connection. Next part of that problem, in conclusion, Hemingway aims to encourage us to consider other people's different paths. Okay, this is, I think we covered this one last week. People's different paths. People's different paths is an instance where one thing owns another thing. So the different paths are owned by the people. Owned, or ownership. Wherever there's ownership, an apostrophe is needed. Apostrophe means ownership. So people's different paths, you put an apostrophe S. And if you've got that error in your essay, I've given you a link to follow up. So please go to that link. There's a nice little explanation with examples of what when you use an apostrophe for ownership and when you don't, and how you put it in plural nouns and singular nouns. Normally, you put apostrophe S in front of a singular noun. Boys, bike. And you put apostrophe after the S in plural. Boys, bikes. So people's different paths is a bit confusing. It's an odd one. People. But the thing is, people is a plural noun in itself. So you don't need to show plurality by putting the apostrophe after the S. It goes before. Now that's a complex one. So you know, there are often exceptions. It's a bit like, mouse is cheese. And then you've got the plural mice. Mice is cheese. And in those two cases, the apostrophe goes before the S, irrespective of whether it's singular or plural, because the plural has already changed its form. But where the plural doesn't change its form, boy and boy, the apostrophe has to go after the S or before the S. That might seem confusing to some of you. Don't worry about it too much. By the time I've picked it up 20 times in your essay, you'll get it. Comment number 4, Hemingway's three main characters, same deal. It's the three main characters that are owned by Hemingway. So Hemingway needs an apostrophe, yes. Owned by Hemingway. They're his three characters. Number 5. The final sentence is sad. Frank wide-legged it towards them, apologizing all the way. Okay. So I'm saying here in comment 9, use a colon rather than a full stop. Because when you are in a sentence introducing a quotation, you don't put a full stop and then the quotation hanging on its own. A colon introduces what you're talking about. So the final sentence is sad. Here's the final sentence, colon. Frank wide-legged it towards them, apologizing all the way. And then the last sentence is father showed no emotion, compassion, or care. And there's a comment there, comment 10, no compassion or care, and I think that was the last sentence in the person's essay, and the comment I made, I think this is a really important detail that could be developed further with a sentence. So, no care. So, again, when you make such a useful insight, no, father had no care, expand it. Let the reader know more about what you mean behind what you've said. You know, writing is such an art because we've got the thoughts, the ideas in our head and in our emotions, and we're trying to transmit that to somebody else. And unless we give them all the details, they're not going to get that something else. So, you know, we need to kind of elaborate, especially when we're talking about literature. 6th one, the story of an hour is a prose about death and the process of grief. The main theme is an underlying realization upon tragedy of life after death, a newly gained. What I'm complaining about here is all these inverted commas. Use inverted commas sparingly. And if you're the guilty party here, I've actually given you some links to look at. But inverted commas are used strictly for quotations from a text. Or they are used around the title of a short story, or the title of a poem, or the title of an essay. Not the title of a book or the title of a play, because they are longer works. And the tradition, particularly in MLA, is longer works are italicized. Like you're talking about a novel, italicized. You're talking about a play, italicized. You're talking about a painting, italicized. But shorter works, poems, essays, etc., inverted commas. Then there's the question about, should I use single inverted commas or should I use double inverted commas? So many bloody rules and things to worry about in English. The rule is, it doesn't matter which of these you use as long as you're consistent. Now, in England, they tend to use that. In America, they tend to use this. And I, in Australia, am tending to use this. I'm tending to use double inverted commas. And with double inverted commas, of course, if there's something that's quoted within those inverted commas, then you use single inside. If you start off with single, you use double inside. But you don't put quotation marks around words that you simply want emphasized. Like this person here is a prose about death and the processes of grief. He's put inverted commas around there because he wants those words to be emphasized. They're not quotations from the text. I'm just, you know, it's like wanting to draw a line under the word. So don't use it for that. Last part of... Oh, there's on the bottom of that, there's number seven. Sorry, that number seven should be out in the margin. Word repetition. Free, free, free. Free body and soul convey a sense of freedom. Word repetition. Repetition is a singular noun. Repetition. Repetition conveys, not convey. So that's again a case of agreement between subject and verb. Over the page. This is evident in the unexpected conclusion planted early in prose. The author hints at a pending volta. Okay, so I didn't quite get what this person was saying here. So I thought, this is evident in the unexpected conclusion. That's a sentence. Put a full stop at the end of that. And then planted early in prose, I thought maybe the author... That this write-up meant the author prepares the reader for this dramatic conclusion through hints in her prose narrative. So it was a bit difficult for me to work out exactly what this writer was saying, but the one thing I did pick up is that this is evident in the unexpected conclusion planted early in prose, the author hints at the pending volta. There's too many ideas there and there's not a clear sentence. So let's make at least one clear sentence and let's see if we can make the other part into another clear sentence. And then there's a quotation. And number eight, each paragraph that follows reveals more context. Semicolon. The conflicting ideals between death and the sense of relief and then emerging joy she feels. So here in this case, the person is introducing a series of ideas. Each paragraph that follows reveals more context. And what context? Conflicting ideals between death, the sense of relief, etc. So that semicolon should be a colon. A colon delivers a series of things. But a semicolon, I tell my students, is like a brick that you put in the middle of the road. If you put a brick in the middle of the road, the first car that's going to hit it's going to be shattered. So when you put a semicolon in the middle of the sentence, it's like putting a stop in the middle when it hasn't stopped. So it's interesting to discover the difference between a colon, which delivers things, and semicolons, which puts a stop. Etc. Number nine, he uses his poetic license to form the rhythm and the structure between poetry and prose. That's a very complex idea. And I've put here comment number 17. Maybe you could say more simply that Winton uses many such poetic devices to create the emotional impact of his story. Your sentence is not entirely clear. How can a poetic license form the rhythm and structure? Poetic license, form, rhythm and structure between poetry and prose. What is this? What's the the poetic, what's the, what is, yeah. So it's complex. So it needs to be simplified. And what I thought that this writer was saying is that Winton uses many such poetic devices to create the emotional impact of his story. You can see if you're marking essays, it's sometimes difficult to kind of intuit exactly what the writer is getting at. Number 10, the images that the writer uses evoke heaviness and harshness of the adults. In the adults. Okay, evokes heaviness and harshness. Right, it could be evokes the heaviness and harshness of the adults, or evokes heaviness and harshness in the adults. I'm now questioning my, you know, my suggestion that it of should become in. Because is the person talking about the way that the adults are kind of heavy people? For example, the smell of whale and muleys and the reference to the sweet and sour smell of the father and the dark cracks in his palms. Second part of that sentence, look, this is not a sentence on its own. In fact, it's actually part of the preceding sentence. For the same reasons as over here, it doesn't have a subject, verb, and an object. It's an example of the first part. The images that the writer uses it evoke the heaviness and harshness of the adults, comma, for example, da-da-da-da-da, that would be fine. 11, two more to go and then we're finished. Kate Chopin has written the text, The Story of an Hour, as more prose than poetry. As prose rather than poetry. Because it is prose. It's not as more prose than poetry. It's definitely prose. Some evidence of this, : the way the text reads across the page, and irregular rhythm of the writing, such as knowing that Mrs. Millard was afflicted with a heart trouble. Evidence includes, again you've got agreement of subject and verb. Evidence includes. Okay, over the page. Whilst there are many themes that run through this story, three themes of import are the isolation of night, the concomitant need for security, and the despair of nothingness. Three themes of import. I would say three of the most important themes. Themes of import is an odd way of expressing. Does he mean themes of import? Three of the most important themes. And I'm asking him to check the meaning of import, which is slightly different from what I think he wants. And then he says, and the despair of nothingness. I thought it should be despair at nothingness, because it's a despair at something. It's not the despair that is the agent. The despair is produced by something. So it's interesting how one word can kind of throw your meaning out. And then last but not least, although the story has great effect on modern readers, it had far greater effect on readers of the period because the themes were shocking then. They touched deep fears and yearnings and sexuality, all of which were taboo for the print media up to that time. It is worse still when her agenda is appreciated. That was a very interesting conclusion, but that last sentence threw me. It needs much more of a context. As it stands, it's somewhat inscrutable. Inscrutable. What was meant by her agenda is appreciated. So, you know, again, a bit like an earlier one, it needs more unpacking for the reader to know exactly where it's coming from. And just in conclusion, I want to read the best essay of the bulk, and it's Joey's. And I'm going to find it for you here. Okay. a writer can choose to compose prose instead of poetry. In prose, the subject matter can be expressed in a more expanded form and with an irregular rhythm. Hemingway writes a clean, well-lighted place as a prose narrative. As a narrative, he can expand dialogue to reveal the composition of the characters, the interplay between the characters, and describe the setting. He can also write without the need for the poetic regular rhythm, which allows him to express his thoughts in a more straightforward and descriptive manner. Without rhythm, he can move between the different perspectives of the characters while still using poetic and literary devices such as metaphor, contrast, imagery, and symbolism. The subject of this story is the interaction between two waiters and an old man and a barman based around a cafe at night in Spain. Whilst there are many themes that run through this story, three themes of import, there we got that example, are the isolation of night, the concomitant need for security, and the despair of nothingness. These first two themes are demonstrated in the older waiter's need for a safe, he's got the apostrophe in there, you see that? He didn't get the top mark because he got that right, mind you. The older waiter's need for a safe, clean, lighted place to spend his lonely, sleepless night. Despair comes through in the musings of the older waiter as he relates his experiences to nothingness. The Lord's Prayer manifests as a symbol of security and order for the waiter, withstanding the nihilistic expression nada that he overlays onto it. The literary device is used to bring the reader to recognize the circumstances of the characters, creating a strong impression of cafe nightlife. Hemingway's feelings about isolation at night and the need for security are highlighted through his use of symbolism and repeated imagery in the motif of the title, A Clean, Well-Lighted Place. Cleanliness recurs through the sentences. The old man is clean. He drinks without spilling. The brandy slopped over and ran down the stem. This is a clean and pleasant cafe, but it is necessary that the place be clean and pleasant, a certain cleanliness and order. The bar is unpolished. The image of light recurs through the sentences. The shadow of the leaves of the tree made against the electric light. The shadow of the leaves of the tree that moved slightly in the wind. The street light shone on the brass number on his collar. The old man sitting in the shadow and all those who needed a light for the night. It also takes place with the sentences, it is well lighted. The light is a very good, and also now there are shadows of the leaves. Turning off the electric light, it is the light of course. Light was all it needed. A shining steam pressure coffee machine. The light is very bright and pleasant, and finally, with daylight, he would go to sleep. This is a powerful piece of prose literature expressing the themes of loneliness, security, and despair, with conflicting views on life topics. Clever use of literary devices such as symbolism, contrast, and a recurring motif of light and clean imagery express Hemingway's feelings on the subject matter. What I liked especially about this essay was the way that it took these ideas and really developed them into seeing what it was in the actual prose itself that gave this impression, this experience of the subject. So, very good. Thank you, John.
Listening to you, it's way more than 300 words. You don't worry about that?
I'm not sure if it is.
Okay.
Not sure if it is. So it's now 3 o'clock. It's time for coffee. So let's go and have coffee and then come back and begin our drama in earnest.
this time.
That's all right. Go and have a coffee.
That's deliberately why I left.
You've come at the right time. But fortunately, it's all been recorded, and fortunately, you'll be able to listen to everything, which is very important.